Welcome. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service. And this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. Let's start with an article that we've been working on from AARP, the magazine. And this is, the main article is entitled, Our Song for America, as four generations of country stars sharing what they treasure most about our nation. Today we're going to start with We Inspire Others by Martina McBride. I got tons of mail about my song Independence Day, people telling me how it gave them the courage to leave a bad relationship. They felt like someone understood what they were doing, what they were going through, or they understood that it wasn't their fault. This song took on a life of its own. Independence Day peaked at number 10, which also taught me that songs are sometimes bigger than a chart number. Martina McBride, 55, has had five number one country singles. Even a farm boy can write an anthem. This is by Lee Greenwood. In 1983, I finally wrote the song that I wanted to write. I put down my feelings, my emotions, my beliefs, that I understand why America is a free country and how we should appreciate it. From that moment on, God bless the USA became more than just my original piece of music. World events, international crises, Hurricane Katrina, and the attack on America in 2001 have made it something more. Event after event brought God Bless the USA and its refrain, and I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free, to the forefront and pushed me into a leading role to be America's patriot. I thought it was important that a farm boy from California could be a patriot. Lee Greenwood, 78, is on his 40 Years of Hits tour through the fall. Natural beauty abounds. This is by Zach Brown. People have become disconnected from nature. An iPad is the standard babysitter for kids. But we're supposed to be scratched up from briars and getting our knees dirty. At my camp, Southern Ground, we take the devices away. We put people out in nature. There is so much power in putting people in a situation where they have to rely on each other. Zach Brown, 43, helped found a Georgia camp that serves young people and veterans. The Zach Brown Band is currently on tour. It's About Community by Lee Ann Womack. In the small town where I grew up, there are dance halls that were built mostly by German or Czech immigrants. They were community centers, a gathering place. People would go there for meetings, like fraternal organizations, then hear music on Saturday night and go to church there on Sunday morning. If you moved to this vast open place called Texas from Germany or Central Europe, you needed a place to feel like you developed, to gather and eat, bring food and music from home. And this is where a lot of these German polka beats you came to hear in early Texas country music and blues and Tejano music came together. Lee Ann Womack, 55, is from Jacksonville, Texas. Over a 25-year career in music, she has won six Country Music Association awards. We Are Pro-Wholesome. This is by Joe Bonzel of the Oak Ridge Boys. The Oak Ridge Boys are very pro-America and pro-God. We don't sing drinking or cheating songs. We're not good at it. There are enough people who do those songs. The Oak Ridge Boys' latest album is Front Porch Singing. Bonzel is 74. A Vow for Democracy by Ronnie Dunn. Our democracy is not something that just shows up. It's something you have to work at, like a marriage. Ronnie Dunn, 69, is the lead singer of the duo Brooks and Dunn. We Share What We Have. This is by Amy Grant and Vince Gill. Amy, I have a friend who lives a simple life. She worked at a dress store. Every year, she would give to my charity her bonus check of $10,000 and say, I feel like you're more in touch with the needs of everyday people. One year, a friend called from the emergency room. A little girl didn't have a coat. That's just one small example of where some of her money went. My friend loved the experience of helping people. She said, this is so much fun. When you give, you look at the world differently. Vince, we get to feel better about ourselves through philanthropy. That is, to some degree, the point of all this. It's like Christmas. When you're giving gifts to family, you want yours to be the one they like the best. Amy Grant, 61, and husband Vince Gill, 65, are still philanthropists. She oversees the Helping Hands Foundation, and he sponsored the Vinny Pro Celebrity Golf Invitational. And finally here today, we are living the dream. This is by Rodney Crowell. I guess for some folks, the American dream is becoming rich and famous. For me, it was finding something I loved and could make a living from. Then, when I witnessed the screaming at four Brits on the Ed Sullivan Show, it registered with me that playing guitar and singing in a band was how you got a girl. My teen rock and roll band wasn't very good, nor was its name the Rolling Tones. Nearly three decades later, I met my wife, Claudia, on the set of a video for my song, Lovin' All Night. So I thank the Rolling Tones because of that band. I chased my dream. Ronnie Crowell, 71, released the album Triage in 2021. Now on to AARP The Bulletin, another article that we're into, Special Report Long-Term Care. A broken system, real problems, real solutions. Making at-home care work for America starts with tackling these six challenges. So we won't get to all of them today, but let's get a head start on it. Challenge number one. Navigating the caregiving world is complex and confusing. Think of the giant industries built around marriage, child rearing, or setting up a home. Each has a wealth of books, magazines, celebrity experts, websites, dedicated brands, even retail stores. Then try to think of the equivalent for in-home caregiving. Right. Unlike other major life transitions, there is precious little infrastructure to guide someone who must make long-term adjustments to their home, career, schedule, and finances in order to care for an aging parent or another loved one. Compounding the issue is that caregiving situations often emerge without much time for advanced planning. What do you do when your parents' health is literally falling apart and somebody has to take care of them? Asked Kitty Easel, a longtime NPR journalist and host of 24/7, a podcast about caregiving. After her father's health declined, Easel moved into his suburban Washington, D.C. home to care for him. I was starting to feel really overwhelmed. Like, where's the roadmap for this? Isn't there someone who's supposed to be in charge? Looking to the federal government will lead a caregiver into a labyrinth. The Department of Health and Human Services, a logical place to start, lists resources for caregivers with links to Alzheimer's.gov, Medicare.gov, the National Institute on Aging, and the Administration for Community Living, ACL. Few would know that the ACL and its subsidiary operation, the Administration on Aging, are the primary parts of the federal government dedicated to caregiving services. The ACL has an annual budget of just over $2 billion. The Biden administration announced an additional $150 million last year to expand the public health workforce for those who serve older Americans and people with disabilities. The largest chunk of that recent funding, $49.8 million, is going to State Units on Aging and Area Agencies on Aging, AAA. Those are the closest thing to a one-stop shop for caregiving as guidance. These Area Agencies on Aging, which can be found by searching the Elder Care Locator at eldercare.acl.gov, offer myriad services, assisting in creating caregiving plans, identifying other services, and offering guidance with transportation, respite care, counseling, and support groups, caregiver education classes, and emergency needs. There are more than 600 area agencies on aging nationwide. Their patchwork nature, which with various names and services, can be a help but can also feed into the confusion. Sandy Markwood, CEO of US Aging, that's USAGING, the association representing and supporting the network of AAAs, points to the RAISE, Recognize, Assist, Include, Support, and Engage, Family Caregiving Advisory Council, that last year sent a report to Congress with 26 recommendations for better caregiver support. The RAISE Family Caregivers Act, signed into law in 2018, tasked the Department of Health and Human Services with establishing a national family caregiving strategy. Next up is implementation, using that as a roadmap to build out, Markwood says. Overall, she says the system needs to recognize, support, and reward caregivers. It needs to be a movement, she adds, and it needs to move pretty quickly. Challenge number two, the lack of workplace support. Caregivers spend on average about 24 hours per week tending to a loved one in need, according to a 2020 study by the National Alliance for Caregiving and AARP. Try juggling that time commitment with a full-time job. The easiest answers to the balance, advocates say, are flexible work arrangements that include paid leave. But selling that concept to businesses and lawmakers has been slow to catch on. Unlike many other industrialized countries, the U.S. does not have a nationalized standard for paid family and sick leave. The Family and Medical Leave Act, FMLA, is the federal law covering a right to time off in such circumstances, providing job protection for caregivers and 12 weeks of unpaid leave but not paid time off. And only 56% of the workforce is even eligible for this. Others are not covered because the size of the company they work for exempts it from the law or they don't work enough hours. The FMLA also has a narrow definition of who qualifies: minor children, parents, and spouses. If you're caring for another loved one, you're out of luck. But even without a government mandate, some large companies are taking it on themselves to offer paid time off for caregiving, especially as the pandemic forced a reassessment of work-life balance and many workers demanded more flexibility. A Kaiser Family Foundation survey in 2021 found that nearly 4 in 10 workers were employed at a firm that began to offer or expanded paid leave benefits during the COVID pandemic. Cisco, a tech company that ranked number one on Fortune's 100 best companies to work for in 2021, allows up to 20 paid days per year of critical time off and expanded that benefit to offer paid time away for caregiving. In a recent employee survey, we found 63% of our people consider themselves caregivers, said Ted Kizios, Vice President of Global Benefits at Cisco, adding that the company wanted to be diligent in supporting our employees and leading with empathy, compassion, and understanding. The company also introduced a U.S. caregiving concierge service during the pandemic to offer one-on-one help to caregivers. Still, in 2021, only about a quarter of U.S. workers had access to employer-provided paid family leave, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Legislative progress is happening at the state level. 9 states and the District of Columbia have paid family and medical leave laws on the books. One of the most recent to get on board is Colorado, where a paid sick leave law and an expanded family leave law were recently passed. The paid family and medical leave law entitles workers to 12 weeks of paid time off a year for a covered purpose. How does Colorado make this work? It has to set up the program as a form of insurance. The premium is initially set at 0.9% of wages, split 50-50 between worker and employer, and paid through a payroll deduction. That means a person earning the average salary of $63,000 a year in Colorado would pay $5.45 per week. The reality of this social insurance program is it helps small businesses because it's a statewide pool, said Jared Make, vice president of A Better Balance, a nonprofit organization that focuses on care and family work policy issues. It allows them to compete with the Googles, who are offering paid leave to attract and retain talent and workers. Make says the state law has been a clear success and that Congress should pass a federal comprehensive leave program modeled on the state laws. We're way behind as a country, he says, but we're starting to see some of the conversation shift. So we'll continue with this next time. Now, I think it's time for a little more of our complete guide to memory. We're on the chapter, this is actually section 3, the spotless mind. Being forgetful or losing your memory altogether can make it hard to function, but active forgetting can clear a path for focus, clarity, and emotional health. When we were young, what happens to our lost childhood memories? Motherhood sent this writer looking for answers, and this is by Missy Ryan. We have a little sidebar here. Your memory of what happened to you between the ages of 3 and 7 is generally pretty patchy, but it gains detail and continuity in the years that follow. When my daughter saw a bumblebee in our garden around the time of her 2nd birthday, she surprised me by talking about being stung by a wasp the summer before, or half her life earlier. Although her memory of the intense pain of a sting wasn't so unexpected, she brought up details I had forgotten, including the fact that we put frozen peas on the welt and that she got a cupcake afterwards. How was it, I wondered, that my daughter, at age 2, had the ability to recollect with such precision something that occurred so far back in her short life, while most of us can't remember much of anything before the age of 4? Like any first-time parent, I have been amazed by how quickly my daughter has transformed from a defenseless newborn to an opinionated little person in the space of a few years. By the time she was 2.5, I could see every day the new ways in which she was building a detailed picture of the world around her, the people and things that were important to her. Back in time. For me, her developmental milestones offered an opportunity of a different sort, the chance to gain new understanding about a forgotten event that had nonetheless loomed large in my own life. I was 2.5 when my father died. He was 28 when his car was hit by a drunk driver. He never regained consciousness and died a few days later. When I was growing up, I sometimes told people that I hadn't known him. Because I couldn't remember anything about the time before the accident, it seemed like the most straightforward answer. More than grief, I experienced a sense of disconnection from an experience that seemed central to my life. When I was young and relatives talked to my older brother and me about it, wanting to share who our father was and express their own sense of loss, I often felt confused and distressed. Now, as my daughter reached the exact age I was when that event occurred, I hoped to answer questions about her and me. What do young children know about those close to them, And why is it that those early moments in relationships, as significant as they may be, often slip away into the haze of forgetting? If I didn't remember my dad, did that mean I hadn't really experienced his sudden absence? I began trying to educate myself about children's capacity to form and retain memories, and why it seems at some point a curtain is drawn across our early recollections. It was around the turn of the 20th century when scientists coined the term childhood or infantile amnesia. The precise age when the veil of infantile amnesia descends is a subject of ongoing debate, in part because only limited studies have been done involving children. But according to Emory University memory scientist Patricia Bauer, the average age for an early memory among Western cultures is 3 to 3.5. And until about age 7, memories are much spottier than they are in later childhood and adulthood. Compounding the puzzle, as Bauer writes, is the fact that within the period eventually obscured by childhood amnesia, children had remarkably rich autobiographies. So what happened to make us forget? That answer we'll save for next time. But we have a sidebar memory hack, Babes in Toyland. You may never be able to recapture your very earliest memories, but to tap some of the feelings and experiences of young childhood, spend an hour walking through the aisles of a toy store. Pay attention to any toys, games, or other items that are identical or at least similar to those you played with as a very young child. Pay particular attention to any stuffed animals, dolls, or action figures you were especially attached to. Imagine that you are playing with these objects as intensely as you once did when you were very young. Envision yourself playing with them in the context you would have done as a child, such as your childhood home or preschool. Then, picture yourself in your favorite childhood outfits. Use any available childhood photos and imagine yourself in those places and clothes. If you have headphones, listen to music from that time. Remember any childhood fixation on dogs, cats, dinosaurs, trains, superheroes, or other favorite topics. Remember any other toys you may have used as a child, which no longer seem to be around. Notice any items you may have longed for as a child but did not possess. Imagine yourself playing with those objects now. Allow your feelings to carry you back to your memories of how you viewed yourself and the world as a child. Buy a gift for the childhood part of yourself. Consider how your current life experience compares to the childhood vision you once had of what your life would be like today. Then think about how to apply any insights to your world, to your vision of what you would like your life to be like in the future. What do you need to do today to help implement that vision? How can you create the kind of personal memories you would like to have in years to come? And now I'm going to go back to our country music edition, On the Road Again. We have time for a few more of these. Some places across America to get your country fix. This is by Peter Cooper. Red Dragon Listening Room, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. A nonprofit run by a former liquor distributor who lives for music. The Red Dragon is filled with mismatched couches and rows of chairs in front of a stage. But don't let appearances fool you. Amazing musicians have played here, including Roseanne Cash and Guy Clark. Buck Owens Crystal Palace, Bakersfield, California. Owens built this restaurant and performance space as a shrine to the Bakersfield sound, which helped transform country music in the 60s and also counted Merle Haggard among its practitioners. The menu includes what is purported to be the last meal Owens ate before his 2006 death, skillet liquor chicken fried steak. The Bluebird Cafe, Nashville. This 90-seat listening room draws some of the finest country songwriters, Garth Brooks and Taylor Swift, are among those who played the bluebird in their younger years. The audience is sworn to silence. You can get tossed out for talking during shows. Grand Ole Opry House, Nashville. The world's longest-running live radio program, the Grand Ole Opry, makes its home here. Each show is packed with a variety of performers, and countless legends have graced its stage. Gruen Hall, New Braunfels, Texas. Built in 1878 in the Hill Country, this is Texas's oldest dance hall. It features rowdy Texas country along with songwriting greats. Recent performers include Lyle Lovett, Patti Griffin, and Ray Wiley Hubbard. Station Inn, Nashville. Nearly every famous bluegrass musician, from Bill Monroe to Ricky Skaggs to Alison Krauss, has played this small but hallowed stage. Seating is general admission, and tickets usually are available only at the door on the day of each performance. Fans line up as much as 90 minutes before showtime to avoid the dreaded sold-out sign. It's worth the hassle. Now, from AARP, the Bulletin, we have two more ways of saving money, and then we're through with this article. But there's another one in the next edition of the magazine. This is number 98. Check a pharmacy discount website, GoodRx. The pharmacy discount website for human medications also lists prices for several online pet medicine pharmacies for brand name and generic pet drugs, where you can find lower prices. The site also offers coupons for savings on some pet drugs. Obviously, this is about your pets. And number 99, the last one, try a pet food subscription or in-store loyalty card. Both can nab you lower prices on your furry friend's everyday chow. A subscription could save you 5% on each order, often with free delivery and, in some cases, a 30 to 35% discount on your first order. Some pet stores offer in-store programs like buy three, get one free for pet food, too. And finally, we have time for a couple of jokes from AARP, the Bulletin. Crystal, did you hear the rumor about butter? Kristen, yes, and I'm not going to spread it. Two friends, did you hear about the guy who changed his name to authorized personnel? It opened a lot of doors for him. Two more friends. Mandy, people laugh at my jokes at the office, but never on Zoom. Randy, that's because you're not remotely funny. Cindy, did you hear about the guy who fell onto the airport baggage carousel? Mindy, no. Did he get knocked out? Cindy, yes, but he came around slowly. Well, folks, we have run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. To be sure and listen at the next same time next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.